one of the things I encountered is our records schedule was way too complicated and detailed. It initially had thousands and thousands of categories, which nobody could figure out what to do with. You know, it took longer to search the appropriate category than anybody had time for. So you have to give broad categories, small numbers of broad categories that will help people figure out what they need to keep for business reasons. Now, for legal and litigation reasons, there's a whole other set of issues. And in the litigation realm, the litigation hold is the key thing in how you administer that, but that's a whole other topic.
Okay. Attachments for emails. The National Archives Electronic Records Archive identified 4,500 different types of files that need to be accounted for as possible attachments to their emails. That makes archiving and managing records exponentially more complicated than managing a piece of paper. How do you deal with this, Jim Michowitz?
You don't. You get a records management consultant to figure this out for you. This is a real tough one. I'm going to bring this up in two different contexts, Carl. The first one is in what's called the life cycle of records management. One of the fascinating areas is how some companies have moved to a storage limit on the active accounts in their email, and what obviously drives the storage counts are usually the attachments. And, it's not unusual now for me to get 3-4 megabyte kind of like attachments that are just like completely taken over a lot of my email accounts. And I think the answer, but it's not necessarily an easy one. I'm really interested in hearing with what Greg's doing at Microsoft, that they've come up with better approaches to this, is to obviously detach that attachment, put it into either a document management system or some kind of foldering capability that allows you for retrieval if necessary. But what often happens, obviously, is that that attachment stays with the email, and then it's just kind of kept there, and then it adds to the great volume that's in there, and then it's also it's harder for retrievability. So again, somewhat I think the answer from a retrieval, maybe from a storage purpose, is to be able to detach that in some, what I'll say, logical, reasonable way to put it into kind of like, I'll pull it more of a document management system to do that. My other context of bringing this up is something that we're dealing with a lot right now in e-discovery, which is as some companies are trying to come up with different filtering devices to reduce the number of documents that need to be reviewed prior to production, the use of just even keywords, let alone any type of concept searching, recognizes that you have the ability to somehow search attachments. And with a lot of the document types like Word documents and the like, yeah, there's text there that you can search across the attachments as well to see if this is a document that is could be responsive or could be privileged or the like. But it's interesting, what we're finding is that a lot of the PDF files, you really have some documents or PDF files that are like non-text documents, and some have what we call very technically gibberish. And it's hard to actually go ahead and retrieve those and identify if they fell into the category of filtered in or filtered out. So one of the challenges we're finding is that based on how companies and how individuals store a lot of their attachments, it may lead to our inability to apply certain types of techniques such as keyword filtering and the like in an efficient manner to reduce the population during the discovery management process.
If I could just add to that, this is Greg. Jim is absolutely right that because attachments tend to be very large, they have a disproportionate impact on eating up storage space, even though they're relatively not as many of them compared to email. One of the ways we're addressing that is that in the new Office 2007, the file formats have changed to be much more efficient. What used to be a 3-megabyte PowerPoint deck will be about 10% of that size. Same for Word, same for Excel. So the file formats and the software can be more efficient to compress that. And secondly, in terms of searching for attachments, Windows Vista allows you to search across everything on your desktop, including attachments. And I think that's also true in Outlook as well. So there are ways to address that. And in terms of the 4,000 and so different types of attachments, I wouldn't worry so much about that exotic number, because the vast majority of them will be in a handful of formats that we're all very familiar with. Yes, there are all sorts of exotic ones out there, but they won't be used very often. If they are, then they might, and if that's a problem, and if there are a lot of them, that might come under the new rules of civil procedure definition of not reasonably accessible. And then lawyers can argue about, you know, the means people need to take to access them. But most of them will be the very familiar PDF, PowerPoint, Word, Excel, and that sort of thing.
Okay, Greg, streaming digital media, what do we do about the audio and visual digital records, which will occur with streaming video, then the proliferation of iPods. You now have these tools to push digital documents to many end users. Is this scary to organizations?
Well, you raise a whole bunch of different issues here, and some of them are scary. First of all, in the streaming technology, I don't think that's scary at all, because to the extent that's like a broadcast or a phone call, you have no legal obligation to record it. And so it never becomes electronically stored information among the people who are listening to the streamed audio or video. So that's not a problem. The moment you do record it, however, then it is electronically stored information. Then you have a problem. And the problem is that currently, voice recognition technology is not quite there yet in terms of doing keyword searches. So if you have, voicemails as email, so you have little audio recordings in your email, or you have, other kind of audiovisual files. That can be more challenging. But I think the vast majority of what we're dealing with still is text. So even though, the other forms can be more complicated and expensive to search, it really depends on your organization as to whether that really becomes a problem.
Dave Cohen, how about un-network records, laptops, home email accounts?
Well, Carl, one of the questions that lawyers are frequently asked, and especially in a litigation context, is is this or that kind of record or this or that source of record potentially subject to discovery in litigation? The answer to that question is virtually always yes, it is. Any way that records can be stored in any place, they're potentially subject to discovery and potentially needed for company purposes as well. So companies do need to worry about the unnetworked records, worry about them for lots of reasons, for security reasons, control reasons, backup reasons. If you have employees storing important company records on their laptops that can be lost or stolen, on their home email accounts, where if they leave the company or if they get hit by a bus or if the computer that they're working with crashes will be lost, that's a problem. And so what's the solution to the problem? Well, one solution is to have controls over that. Don't have company policies that prohibit the storage of records in places where the records aren't backed up and aren't accessible to the company. One very common situation is where people do archive their emails. They very often, for example, under Outlook, will set up personal folders in PSTs that may be on hard drives. And very often there are hard drives on there. PCs or laptop computers aren't backed up regularly, so that's a problem. The information can be lost, and it's also harder to gather if litigation hits and you have a litigation hold. One simple solution to that in many companies can be simply to move those personal folders under their inbox, and so that the folders are then stored on shared servers that are regularly backed up. That's not necessarily an answer for every company. You need to talk to your IT people, but that's a very simple solution for eliminating one of the areas of problems with email storage in PST folders.
Okay, websites. This is for you, Ed Wolf. An extreme example of the changing context of records is the corporate web portal. Does that now have to be managed like a document, just like a contract or intellectual property? I've heard websites for financial services companies being referred to as fruit salad web pages because they've got so much activity and third-party information that's flowing through them. Any thoughts on websites?
I think, you know, as part of any records management, what we broadly would call information lifecycle management, as well as any electronic discovery processes, I think you have to have, you know, email is a heavy hitter as our standard office documents. But when you get into websites and applications and things of that nature, they equally have to be treated. And I think one of the important things about websites is the first thing a company has to do is understand what websites it has. And what we've done is we have a registration process. To have a website, it must be registered. And then you have to have rules around it. You have to have rules around what is it used, who owns it, what is the content of that website, how interactive it is, and then rules around what information that is retrieved and developed and outputted on the website has to be retained. It's an extraordinarily difficult exercise, but you have to put accountability and responsibility on the owner of it to manage it and make sure that the information that has to be retained for regulatory purposes, for litigation purposes, or for business needs, you have to find an IT solution to do that. And I think for a lot of us, this is a work in process beyond that, which we absolutely know has to be retained.
If I could just jump in on that, this is Greg. I agree. I think websites are one of the most difficult issues we face, in part because what we're dealing with here is dynamic data. And I wrote an article about that and how it should be treated in the law. And I think it goes back to, you know, you're sitting at your typewriter or at your computer and you're creating a draft. And you may have all sorts of revisions to it, but you don't have an obligation to save every change that is made along the way. Similarly with databases that are continuously updated, it's just information streams into them in real time around the clock. You cannot take snapshots every millisecond to record every last change. And so obviously if you have something that is electronically stored in the sense of somebody did save it as a snapshot in time, then that is, of course, producible in discovery and has to be preserved. But websites are just very often living, breathing documents that are updated all the time, and I'm not so sure what the law is in terms of, you know, when you have to preserve every version, every change. As Ed said, it really depends on the purpose and the use of it. In some highly regulated areas like HR or securities, there may be particular statutory obligations. From a litigation point of view, I don't think you can put all the relevant websites under some litigation hold and basically take snapshots of them all the time.
Yeah, and I agree with Greg. You cannot possibly have a system in which you are going to have version control such that every version is captured. You have to really look at the content and what absolutely needs to be preserved, because there's no way you can practically do a comprehensive and all-inclusive version control.
That article, by the way, is in your materials. It's the 15th tab, e-discovery of dynamic data and real-time communications, new technology, practical facts and familiar legal principles. Okay, the next question is for Jim Michowitz, duplication of files. Proliferation of copies started with copying machines, faxes, LANs, along with C drives and floppies, internet forums, and sharing of records with collaborators. How do you deal with the copies with a record management system?
Carl, I guess my experience has been more dealing with this issue downstream when it hits an event such as litigation or investigation. So in the records management, again, upstream with the life cycle, I guess the question is, how big of an issue really is duplication? What kind of defect and what kind of detractor does it cause within the life cycle? And I guess I can come up with two things. One is that the proliferation leads to larger volumes of storage of stuff that might not be necessarily needed for retention. And I guess the second piece would be it could hamper your ability to retrieve data because you retrieve too many copies. But if you look at it, most people, I think, are kind of really when most of retrieval in their own active, be it email or in their active file folders, and I don't think that that's that much of a problem, so they're kind of self-managed. Where that can be a problem is files in shared drives, where there normally needs to be someone who serves as kind of like the owner to maintain some kind of integrity of those so there isn't a proliferation. But, again, I'll throw this out, and I'm very open to having pushback. I don't know if the duplication of file issue causes as much upstream as it does downstream, where now you're faced with not only having to review the materials, but you're also looking for consistency in what type of decisions you make on those documents. And that's where we found the biggest problem is. So I think there's been a number of companies who really have developed, I think, some very good deduplication, near duplication kind of software to handle the inception of files for litigation so as to reduce that number. And I'm realizing that the duplication can come not with just within a custodian but across custodians. If you've had to retrieve documents from, let's say, from backup tapes as well as from the active area, there's that great risk of duplication as well. So, again, my answer is probably not as strong as you'd like to hear it, but I think you face with this issue more the downstream. I think there's tools to do it, but upstream within the lifecycle management, I don't know if this is as big of an issue, but I'm open to criticism of that.
Okay. This is for Greg, changing metadata dates. Files often have data about the date, such as the date the file was created, are often not transferred accurately when the files are copied for litigation. For example, magnetic storage devices such as hard drives allow for three-part date storage: system, created, access, modified, whereas the file architecture of an optical media such as a CDR only allows for one date. This creates difficulty in litigation when lawyers need to create a chronology. What are your thoughts on changing metadata dates?
I mean, I think a lot of the focus on metadata at these conferences is a little excessive. It's not as important as some people think it is. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, if only I have every last scrap of metadata, then I can really win my case, and that'll give me the smoking gun. I think in terms of the burdens of preserving it, you know, the benefits of its preservation are not necessarily commensurate. That said, you know, there should be ways of doing it, and when you're producing documents in discovery, it's usually best to do so in a fixed format, like TIFF, but you can also save the metadata alongside it. Now, will every scrap of metadata be perfectly preserved? No. I mean, you have to take a reasonableness approach to it. And, you know, last access date is by definition the date it was last accessed. And if you access it for litigation purposes, well, that date will change, and people shouldn't be surprised by that. You know, if this is some kind of a criminal investigation where it is crucial to know at what time, on what day, the witness last looked at a document, well, then you should say so in your discovery conferences, and then maybe that's worth paying a lot of attention to. Otherwise, yeah, you have to be aware that there is metadata. That is one of the things that makes electronic documents different from paper. Although, just think back to the paper world. You could have yellow highlighting on a piece of paper, and it gets photocopied in the production process, and the yellow highlighter doesn't show up on the you know, photocopy. So you lost some metadata. You know, was that something always worth fighting about? I don't know.
Losing data is a problem that Ken Thibeau, head of the National Archives Electronic Records Archive, wrote about. He said electronic records are being sent to the archives at 100 times the rate of paper records, and his observation is we don't know how to prevent the loss of most digital information that's being created today. Do you worry about the loss of data when building electronic record systems? And that's for David Martin.
When I look at how we build our electronic record system, I look at the business purpose of the document, how we're trying to save it, what we're using it for. And so I look at that from that sense. I'm not worried about the loss of digital information. If I mean, we have to rely on our vendors. We have to rely on the people that built the system that say, basically, this system works, and it's adequate for our business purposes. So if we lose some data, we lose some data. And the question comes down to, is that an issue in the courtroom? I don't think it is. Is it an issue in the business? It may be, but I haven't seen a lot of observations like the one to which you refer. We don't know how to prevent the loss of most digital information. Our systems, we're told that we retain it and that it's getting there, and I think I have to rely on that.
Dave Cohen, what do we do about proprietary formats? I'm referring to legacy systems. Older documents from the 80s and 90s were created with these systems.
Well, in terms of the company's ongoing business, it's usually not a problem because typically companies convert whatever they need once they shift from one format to another. It becomes an issue when you get into litigation and discovery requests go back to information that's on old legacy systems, and then you're expected to go back and find them and produce them. You know, to some extent, it's not all bad that stuff might be difficult to find and produce, because now with the new federal rules and state courts tracking some of those rules, you can make the argument that certain records are not reasonably accessible and therefore that the burden of producing them outweighs the benefit and that you shouldn't have to produce them. And very often that may get you out of having to produce information that's in a proprietary format that you no longer have access to, or if the other side really pushes for production of that information, you can often seek cost shifting, have them be forced to pay for the cost of trying to find the old software and systems that are necessary to restore the information. But typically, it's, you know, information that's that old in your system, you're not usually looking for it for your own purposes. You're usually worried about it if somebody else is requesting it, and then it's best to put the burden on them if possible to try to restore it and have them cover the costs.
Unnecessary data. This is for you, David Martin. What do you do about the huge volume of documents created by employees which have no business value, such as logistical data, you know, scheduling lunches, meetings, and lunch dates, or passing along useful reading information, sports banner, passing around jokes, the latest pass this on to 10 of your friends for good luck within 72 hours and good things will happen to you. If not, bad things are going to happen to you. If you don't have a retention policy, this stuff's being saved on servers. I read something that Enron, it took 1,000 attorney hours to review a lot of this type of stuff from a third-party company that was subpoenaed.
Well, obviously, whether you have a retention policy or you don't have a retention policy, this stuff is going to end up on servers, it's going to end up on backup tapes, it's going to end up as a part of your system unless the people delete it themselves when they get it. And so I look at that and I say that's training, and it is one of the biggest problems that we face, because there are people that don't delete anything. And so if you have an archiving system, you're going to pick that up unless you have a delay in archiving. But the biggest way that you can deal with this is training, 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 because each individual has control over their own email box, and each individual has to pay attention to what shows up and get rid of that stuff that's totally personal, lunch dates, sports banner, jokes, all of the garbage that is a part of the way people communicate today. And I frankly don't know of any software or any solution other than archiving stuff, say, let's say 30 days out, which gives people time to get rid of this on their email. I don't know of any solution to that. It's going to be on backup tapes. It's going to be out there unless you can train your employees to get rid of it.
Dave Cohen, I would jump in. I completely agree. Training is a big part of that. And another solution, I think what many companies are doing now is making the default that emails do disappear if employees don't take affirmative steps to file them and archive them after some set period of time. And for different companies, it could be 60 days or 90 days or 6 months. But at some point, the emails should disappear unless somebody thinks they're important enough to archive. Nevertheless, in every litigation matter we get involved in, you're going to have a very large proportion of records that you have to go through that are going to be these kinds of unnecessary records that aren't in any way relevant to litigation but still take time and money to sift through. And in those situations, I would harken back to some of the software programs that Jim Michowitz was talking about earlier for deduplication. There's some programs that do a wonderful job not only of eliminating duplicates and making review more efficient, but they can also organize reviews by concepts in documents. We're heavy users of a 10X. Other programs that are out there include programs like Stratify, Catafora, and Semantic. And these programs will help you go, at least in a litigation context, quickly sift through what's not needed and get to the more relevant records in much less time than if you just go document by document without these software systems.
If I could just jump in, this is Greg. What you just said was absolutely key. The crucial thing is to change the default to non-retention. You know, the current default for most people is that everything is kept unless you do something about it, because it's so easy to do so in email, in PST files, and places like that. You've got to change it so that unless somebody needs something and needs to keep it, it goes away. Now, the one exception to that that's very important is that if somebody is on litigation hold, then you have to switch the default back to keeping things. Because you can't have people going on vacation or not paying attention and then things that are needed for litigation being automatically deleted. But aside from that, you know, and assuming you've taken care of all your other regulatory areas, the default should be non-retention.
Okay.
Carl, if I can just pick up what Greg said, because I think it's a really important point about the default not being to retain. And this is a real change in terms of how people have approached this in the past, because I think spoliation, inability to produce in a timely manner has been kind of like the predominant factor in people's thinking, especially in e-discovery. So if you kind of now go back upstream and about the retention, now that people are seeing that if you keep everything, it is going to be costlier. It sounds like it's safer, but it not necessarily is, but it is going to be costlier. And the one thing that I know we have not touched on so much in this conversation are the backup tapes and legacy systems. And this is the area where a lot of our clients who are trying to be proactive so that they don't keep everything are struggling, you know, because they're just, it's not, unfortunately, there are not that many devices that are out there. I think there's some that we're looking at right now that gives you the ability to do like a quick peek. And again, when you're talking about legacy data that's on tapes, the ability to go ahead and find the software that can allow you to bring that up, to recover it, and then to do some kind of indexing so that you have the ability to make a decision as to why that needs to be retained or not, it's just, it's kind of limited as to what your choices are that are out there. So the one thing I'll just say, I absolutely support what Greg said. I think an area of opportunity is for those who can come up with, I'll call it the quick peek system, to allow businesses to look at some of the legacy data and some of that data that's on backup tape that's just been out there, which are dangerous, but there's no ability to quickly decide if that needs to be retained or not. But if you had the tool to do that, I think that'd be something that'd be helpful in the marketplace.
Jim, just to jump in, you know, backup tapes are so important. One question that any company should ask is why are they retaining this information for long periods of time? Especially with the new federal rules, there's a movement towards using backup tapes only for disaster recovery purposes, not for archiving purposes. And if you are only going to use the backup tapes for disaster recovery purposes, then why do you ever need to keep the information more than a few weeks? Companies have had to spend a fortune when they've got backup tapes going back months and years, because that tends to be a lot of the most voluminous information, a lot of the most costly to restore and search for potentially relevant information when litigation hits.
Dave, you and I, you know, we're on the same page with that one. And
amen. This is Greg.
Yeah, absolutely, as far as that.
Yeah, completely.
And I think the one thing we're just finding with some of our clients is that they didn't make that decision, and now they're kind of hit with this kind of like backlog of backups. And, you know, and they're trying to go ahead and unearth themselves from this and have the ability to go through these and try to make some kind of decision on them. So I'm absolutely right with you as far as moving forward, just to reduce as far as that backup time period.
And you raised retention. This is Greg. You raised the question of why do companies keep all those old backup tapes around? Well, actually, I think generally it's for no particular reason at all. You know, it's because people weren't thinking about it, and the easiest thing is just to keep stuff if you're not thinking about it, until, of course, you run into all the costs and risks associated with that. And you're right. For archiving purposes, backup tapes are terrible. They're not designed for retrieval or finding things easily. It's extremely expensive. So there really is no particular reason to keep them beyond a couple of weeks, because if there's really going to be a disaster, you should know it the same day. And you should set about, you know, recovering from your disaster within days or weeks and not months.
You know, we talked about here about the time bombs of these backup tapes. So what about the smaller little minefield of the CDs or floppy disks, which are nooks and crannies in our offices? You know, as lawyers, do you think they should get into the record management process, or are they just ticking minefields, which might never go off because no one knows what's on them and they're buried in desk drawers? And I'm just going to throw that one out in the open. Or Jim Mike Woods, you're
oh,
talking.
Oh, thanks. The way I was just talking, I thought I was done my piece. Oh, man, Carl.
You know what? Ed Wolf. Okay.
Well, I think you have to address them as painful as it is. And I think you have to do kind of a triage approach to them and to try to ascertain the extent to which it is relatively easy to know what types of information are on them, and generally categorize them. And on the other end of the spectrum, you're going to literally have, you may have an off-site storage, just a whole box of CDs or floppies. And, you know, that's some of the types of things that, you know, you don't know what to do with. Clearly, I think you'd take the position that that is something under the rules that you're going to say is inaccessible. But it's, you know, once they're there and they're in front of you, I don't know how you ignore them.
Greg McCurdy, multi-party social networks. My kids can't live without these. They're with their network of friends on MySpace and other similar sites. My guess is these types of highly collaborative pages will develop business applications. What would be your sense of how to handle this area?
Well, they already have developed business applications, and it's peer-to-peer collaboration technologies like Groove, which is a company we acquired 2 years ago, and it's going to be part of the new Office 2007 in a number of the SKUs. And what it basically allows you to do is you set up a workspace for a project or a case, and you invite various people to become members of that workspace, and you give them certain rights as administrators, users, or guests that allow them to add documents, edit documents, delete documents, post emails. There's sort of instant messaging type functionality. And everybody has a copy of that workspace on their PC. There's no real server involvement. And if you're offline on an airplane, say, and you're editing a document, and then you sync back up to the network, your changes are propagated to all the other copies of the workspaces that all the other users have. So that raises a number of interesting retention questions, especially from a litigation point of view, because what we've been doing is putting individuals under retention and saying, okay, you're the people who are involved in the issues in this case. You've got to keep all the documents related to this case. Well, now you may have somebody who's under retention who's a member of such a workspace, such a peer-to-peer collaborative software environment, and other people have the rights to edit and delete their documents. So that can be a little tricky. So I think you have to start thinking about, in addition to just putting individuals under retention, having a way to identify the subject matter of these collaboration sites and see if they relate, and then put the site under retention. Now, again, you have the dynamic data problem in that, you know, you have drafts and multiple people editing something and you can't keep every last change, but you do have to worry that people don't delete things that are there. You know, it is a significant problem. It's a very cutting edge one, very much up there with the website problem.
Okay. This is for you, Ed Wolf, on the definition of records. There's a problem some consultants have identified of focusing on one definition of a record, which can miss documents. If you focus on only one aspect of a record, such as cultural or scientific purposes, litigation purposes, regulatory purposes, or business process or knowledge management purposes, you'll likely miss a business or governmental requirement, for example. What are your thoughts on that area?
Well, I happen to agree with that. I think when you're talking about records, you generally have to talk about content, because the content of what a record is what really drives any obligation to retain for business, litigation, regulatory, or whatever purpose. You may be able to generally tie records to business functions, usually as a creating organization, but to try to overly define and be over granular makes it more difficult to find records, more difficult to retrieve them, and it really misses the boat. You have to really focus on what is the content of a record, because that's what the user is gonna understand, and really when you get in litigation, that's how you're going to be looking at a record.
Okay, the last question in this area deals with system shortfalls, and this is for you, Greg. One of the issues facing records management is the fact that most every computer application dealing with documents does not keep in mind the issue of preservation. Do we need better software applications?
Well, it's important to keep that in mind. I mean, just think of it this way. The typewriter was created to create documents, and then you created the file cabinet to have a place to put them. You have an email program that now allows you to create emails, and it also has associated a file system where you can organize and keep them. So yes, I think it is important for the design of software products to keep that in mind, and I think that has already been done to a good extent and will be done a lot more.
Okay. We're going to move into the last section, and we're not going to cover it in as much detail as I was planning to. This is trends in electronic records management. We'll probably spend 10 minutes, maybe 15, in this area. One question I have here is for David Martin. Let's talk about the speed in which record management programs were cut during past recessions at many companies. This is an area considered a cost center. Today, there's a heightened profile for the management of electronic records. Is this just a result of the recent spectacular corporate fines and litigation cases destined to be phased out once new issues face corporations and these issues fade?
I don't think so. And partly, I don't think so because I don't think that the issues are going to fade for some time. The reason for that is not everybody is on board and not everybody is taking the steps to get ready. So I think we're going to have some continued spectacular cases in which there's some huge fines or there's some orders that get entered that get everyone's attention. On the other hand, I think that companies are primarily moving to electronically stored information, and everybody's just simply learning more about it, and people are talking about it not as much in the legal sense, but across the board in terms of the need to understand how these programs work and what they're doing. So I think that the corporations now know that this is a priority. They now know that this is just a different kind of management, a different kind of records management. I think the dollars are there, and it's just an issue that will continue, and I don't see the corporations turning away from it.
Dave, this is a hard question for anyone to answer on this panel, but I've read some of the fines in the SEC vein were like $10 million for a couple of the financial services company, not for retaining records long enough. But do you think the fines are high enough to force ongoing attention to this area, or is a multi-million dollar fine a reasonable risk given the challenges and costs associated with doing this well, if that's really even possible today?
I think that really the fines are just the beginning of the problem. The companies that were fined didn't get to pay the fine and do nothing else. They had to pay the fine and then fix their systems so that they ended up getting the double whammy anyway. They had to pay to make the records accessible and pay the fine. The fines are not only potentially in the multiple millions of dollars, but we've seen a number of court decisions with verdicts in the multiple millions of dollars, ranging from the $29 million verdict in the Zubilee case to the granddaddy of them all, the $1.4 billion verdict in the Morgan Stanley case. And so I don't think it's a matter of being able to choose to say, okay, I'm just going to run the risk and worry about paying these costs and fines. I think companies is definitely cost justified to do what's necessary to comply with record retention requirements where there are record retention requirements, and to certainly have litigation hold procedures that work so that you don't get stuck with sanctions in a litigation context. We actually did a 50-state research project on what are the record retention requirements for different kinds of records all throughout the United States and under federal law and D.C. law for about 1,000 different record types. And we found that there are no requirements for the vast majority of documents. There are certainly certain kinds of documents, certain employee records and environmental records and financial records that you have to retain for corporate compliance purposes, for regulatory compliance purposes. And then another particular industry, certainly the SEC, has record retention requirements that are pretty strict. But generally, most record retention is driven by company needs and business needs as opposed to regulatory requirements. And there's lots of reasons to have records accessible, but some of the most important are for the business's own needs.
This is sort of a double-edged question, and it's for Ed Wolf, but it's also put a plug out to a future presentation I'd like to do. I'd like to do another presentation in a few months focusing on the often ignored middle market company, say $500 million to $5 billion in revenue, and how they're attacking this electronic records management mess. First of all, if anyone in the audience would like to participate in that, please send me an email, get in touch with me. It's hard to find people in that segment that are doing a lot of work. At least I've had some trouble with that. But Ed Wolf, do you have any advice from the I forget how many billion dollars General Motors is at, but do you have any advice to offer these types of companies?
Well, I think that these companies are big enough that they're already experiencing as Greg says, the almost exponential increase in electronic information, and I think it behooves companies of this size to try to start tackling the management of electronic records while it is still relatively manageable, because it becomes even more difficult as the business would grow and as your records grow to retrieve and to share information for business needs, much less legal requirements. So, it's a good time to get on board before it really hits you in full explosive effect.
This is, I don't know if there's a good answer for this, and I'm giving it to you, Dave Cohen, but I read this scary article recently in Popular Mechanics called Digital Ice Age, which talks about the shelf life of digital media not being infinite, and cited an example aboard the USS Nimitz when older engineering drawing files were opened up with a new CAD software, the designs had subtle changes. Is this a real threat to companies who are making these substantial investments in electronic records management?
Well, it is certainly something that companies need to begin to pay attention to. It's certainly understandable that with the move to electronically stored information from paper records, there's things that people didn't think of before, sort of like whole Y2K problem. People had to figure out that you needed a four-digit year codes in dates to avoid some of the problems that we ran into there. We now know that this is a problem. We now know that various kinds of software and hardware become outdated and media does not last forever. And that's why it's so important to have records managers in companies who understand the technology and can make this one of the issues that they pay attention to. Those records that you're going to need in the future, you can't just wait and leave them in their old format for 50 years. You need to be continuously updating them and also quality controlling the update to look for these kinds of subtle changes. so that when you need to access a record 50 years down the road, the record is in an accessible form. Simpler example of this, I read an article in the paper this morning about people moving their old home movies from VCR tapes to DVDs because that way they'll have them 50 years from now, and the DVDs won't degrade as quickly as VCR tapes and so on. Companies need to be treating their business records the same way with that small category of records that they really may need to access far into the future, which again, is a very small proportion of the total records that they create and keep.
Now, this is Greg. If I could just jump in on that. I mean, it's absolutely true, and people should watch out for their DVDs, too, because that technology will be displaced by a new one before too long. I mean, there's already the Sony's Blu-ray format and Toshiba's HD DVD formats that may someday become the standard. And this is really nothing new. I mean, new technology comes along, but also media just obsolesce. Paper crumbled, ink fades. Remember thermal fax paper? That stuff didn't last very long at all, even back in the era when the fax machine was king.
Hey, I still listen to my 8-tracks. Jim Eichowitz, your job description is unique among panels here in that you cover both records management and electronic discovery. Record management's been with us about 10,000 years back to the Babylonian era. E-discovery's been with us for about 8 to 10 years. Would you like to weigh in on whether records management can learn from e-discovery on how to deal with the management of electronic records, or should e-discovery learn from records management tools?
I think one of the real great benefits of the rules changes was forcing this discussion between the records management, particularly the IT group, and the Office of General Counsel. And I think that this was led to kind of like people who can serve as multilinguists, who can share, and those experiences maybe from the e-discovery, which is more the event-driven thing, to the life cycle folks. So I think it's really an integration, Carl, of the two. I think it's a meeting together. However, having said that, I will tell you that my own particular kind of like evolution, and even the way we approached this at Sedona, was to go more downstream into the e-discovery. And we have, again, a lot of the data, a lot of the cases that led to a lot of the data, and then to use that in ways to say, this is how you can do some preventative steps, and now apply this back upstream. So my feeling is that, again, it probably has a lot to do with what my primary position was, which was more litigation management, was to get that data, be able to kind of demonstrate it more on the event side, which is downstream, e-discovery, then bring it back upstream into the life cycle management and then to apply it that way. So that's just my one thought about that. Now, having said that, I will say that I think one of the really helpful pieces to what has happened over probably the last even 5 years is the introduction of companies in the e-discovery marketplace who did not really come out of litigation support. They really had used information management tools within different disciplines, be it in defense, be it nuclear science, whatever like that, where the ability to retrieve data was really key. And we just have, I think, in some ways in the legal area, been kind of behind the time. So I think the introduction of people from the non-legal arenas into information management, be it e-discovery, then further upstream. And the last thing I'll just say is I think we can learn a lot. I know you quoted earlier, Carl, the NIST group, you know, as far as the standards group there, and also Jason Barron with NARA, with the National Archives. Their ability to manage huge volumes of data and a lot of archival data and the like, I think we're learning a lot. And I know Jason's involvement in Sedona had been very helpful because it takes you outside of just the corporation to other areas. And I have learned a lot personally by seeing how the government sometimes has to manage this kind of flow, and then to take those learnings and apply it both into the e-discovery but also upstream.
Okay, we've hit a period now where we're just past 4 o'clock, and we've got a whole bunch of questions still on taxonomies and folksonomies and all sorts of future trend stuff, but I think probably a lot of people in the audience have some questions that they'd like to address to the panel. And while we're arming the phones for that, I'm going to start with one right now that someone from a large industrial company gave me to ask. and this was an observation, a question which seems hard to answer for most e-discovery panels, is when do you pull the trigger to alert the rank and file of their obligation to preserve when litigation is, quote, reasonably anticipated? And how far does that duty extend to smaller pieces of litigation?
Well, Carl, jump in and say you pull the trigger immediately. I mean, the hard part of the question isn't when you do it after litigation is reasonably anticipated. The problem usually is identifying when the litigation is reasonably anticipated. But once you've gotten to that point, any loss of records after that is potentially spoliation. And even a delay of a few weeks or even a few days, if potentially relevant records are lost, the other side is going to try to make an issue out of that. I think the harder question is, when is litigation reasonably anticipated? If you're a big company and every time you discharge an employee, the employee threatens that they may sue, does that mean you immediately need to put a record hold into place? And I think you need to be guided by common sense and by past experience in those kinds of situations, remembering that the issue is only going to come up in hindsight. It's only going to come up in those cases where, in fact, the employee did go ahead and file a lawsuit afterwards, and now you're going to have to justify why you didn't retain records. But if you can show a track record that, you know, you get 100 of those threats and only one in 100 turns into litigation, then you have a good argument that litigation wasn't reasonably anticipated just because you received a threat. On the other hand, once you receive a complaint, a claim letter from opposing counsel, those are more likely to trigger a record hold.
I think another thing that factors into this, too, is if you're a company that faces repetitive litigation, as some industrial companies do, and you can actually take some proactive steps when you're building your retention schedules, that if you know that you're going to have repetitive litigation on a subject, you may keep records longer than the business need would dictate, so that you're not constantly peppering the organization with litigation holds, because you can overwhelm a company with too many litigation holds. And then, you know, for the cases where you have a lot of information that would not be covered by the retention schedules, that's when you can most effectively get your holds out right away.
Good. Now, my understanding is that each of the 50-some-odd locations now can speak up and ask questions. So, you know, you can all try it once, and we'll answer the questions we hear.
Okay. To join the question-and-answer session queue, press 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember, if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you're selected to ask your question. Do you have any more email questions?
Sure, I have another question here. Actually, this came from today's newspaper. There's a new book that suggests that cluttered desk is not such a bad thing. This was written by, It's a Perfect Mess, written by, I think they were a Columbia University management professor. But they suggest that people and businesses shouldn't waste time resolving being more neat, efficient, and orderly, because organization has costs in terms of time and resources, and the unrecognized benefits from mess include inventiveness, flexibility, and even efficiency. What are your reaction to sort of the flip side of too much records management?
This is Greg. I've encountered that, and perhaps it's a special thing for Microsoft because we have a lot of engineers, and engineers seem to want to keep everything, and many of them are pilers rather than filers. And so if you tell them they should start sorting through what they ought to keep and what they ought not to keep, a lot of them are very unhappy, and they don't want to spend time doing that. They just want to keep piling everything away. And so that is our biggest challenge, and I presume some other industries face that as well. And it is somewhat time-consuming. Now, for somebody like me, somebody who's a filer, it's just natural to file things away because that helps me find them and organize what I need to do. You know, in the end, I think for the pilers, we'll have to rely on search technology in order to find things, and also, you know, on the default being non-retention after a certain amount of time, but giving people, you know, very long retention periods, but just not infinite retention periods.
I'm trying to remember which of the panelists had a bad reaction when I was talking about, you know, Googling versus static taxonomies.
I think it was David Martin.
That was David Martin, okay. I think to the situation where the likelihood of finding an obscure film in, say, a Blockbuster store versus typing the film's title in it, you know, a website, maybe Blockbuster's website, for example. There just really isn't any comparison. You can come up with titles a lot easier that way. Do you think we're ever going to get to that level of robust searching capability? David Martin, I'll let you and Ed Wolf take cracks at this one.
I don't think that we are ever going to get there. I think there's reasons not to get there. And I think that, you know, the way a corporation does business, the problems related to privacy, the problems related to confidential information, to trade secrets, and all the rest of that really prevent you from having that kind of a robust searching ability, because how do you put limitations on who can use it and where? I mean, I suspect those are solvable problems, but I just don't. The whole concept bothers me immensely.
And I think there's a kind of a continuum on this. I think that taxonomies are very useful when you have, you know, common record types across an organization, particularly a global organization, so that you are all working from kind of the same attributing and searching scheme. That being said, it would be wonderful to have a more fluid ability to search. But when you get into some of the things like some of the websites and some of the applications and the like, you face limitations there as well. So I think, you know, where you end up with a lot of the fluid searching is downstream when you're doing your review in electronic discovery tools and software. So I think there's always going to be kind of a tension there, and I don't think, well, we're at least close to getting there.
Okay. I have another question, but before I ask that,
I do have one more live question.
Good, because I used to be at a radio show in the University of Hull in England, and I used to always ask the audience to call in, and I didn't know if it was the fact that I was an American in an English country and no one wanted to call in a question, but this has been sort of caused me psychological damage. So
okay.
I'd love someone to get a question out here.
Go ahead with your question, Atlanta, Georgia.
Hi, can you hear us?
Yes, we can.
Yep.
Okay, I am an analyst with the litigation department of Powell Goldstein, and we have followed very closely the changes, and I must make a comment that your panel is outstanding. I have attended several conferences, and this has been truly very helpful. Back to my question now. Given the new rules, the meet and confer session needs to occur within 90 days of filing the complaint, which means that the attorneys don't have enough time to prepare in order to effectively represent their clients at that meet and confer session if they are not prepared ahead of time. And most of the comments were made what the corporations or the potential clients of the lawyers need or are doing and what are the best practices in that. But I have questions for the in-house attorneys as well as the litigator on the panel. For the in-house attorneys, what would you like to see your outside counsel do ahead of time to effectively represent you? And for the litigator, what would you like to see your clients do so you represent them effectively at that meet and confer session? Thank you.
Well, I'd be glad to jump in first, if you don't mind having the answers in reverse order. We're actually recommending that companies set up teams of knowledgeable people in-house who are poised to jump into action, because your question really hits the nail on the head. If you haven't prepared in advance, it's awfully hard to get ready for any big piece of litigation in that short time frame that you have. And so we actually even coined a name. We say companies should set up alert teams, with the alert standing for Advanced Litigation and E-Discovery Response Team. So it's a little bit corny, but it helps people remember. And we recommend that those teams include representatives from the in-house legal department or whoever's in charge of the in-house legal function, as well as IT representatives. And certainly if you have records managers in charge of hard copy records, they should be included as well. And that team should be planning in advance knowing that litigation may be coming down the pike, have mapped out where your information resources are, have your record hold procedures in place beforehand, and have responsibilities assigned beforehand so you know once the litigation comes in how you're going to handle it. You may want to have your outside counsel be involved in helping you set up that process, as well as knowledgeable experts from consulting companies like ACT and others. So you do need to be prepared in advance. And another technique that some companies are moving to when they are regularly subject to litigation is hiring special e-discovery counsel, where the same firm will represent them on the e-discovery issues in any case and will get to know their systems and be prepared on those issues, even where that firm's not also their primary counsel in the litigation. That firm comes in to specialize in the e-discovery work, and therefore can be prepared on those issues and also brings to bear their learning and their expertise on those issues. And so think about hiring special e-discovery counsel so that you're ready for those litigation situations.
Yeah, and this is Ed Wolf. I agree with the concept of having a coordinated in-house team consisting of legal, IT, and also the business units, because I find particularly when you get into applications and websites, you have to have the business owner know what's in the system, and then you have to have the IT figure out how they can search and retrieve against it. So you have to have a team in place and almost an inventory of what your company's data stores are, what the volumes are, what the capabilities are, and kind of a game plan of how you would generically attack each type. And then from an outside counsel perspective, I think you have two things. On some of the easier things to deal with, like email, office products, and the like, you can use this team to inform them. When you have more specific and more granular areas like specific applications, specific databases, say you're dealing with math data or the like, you may well want to have one or two counsels that are specializing in that. That can either be at hearings and meet and confers with counsel in the case or take it over completely.
Let me throw some. This is Jim Leichwitz, both to those answers. Is the role of the discovery manager, and this would be within a corporation, and it's a job which I know I held, and I've seen that there's more and more advancement in this area of people who have that responsibility in-house, and not necessarily attorneys. Many are, but some are not attorneys, that who actually attend the meet and confer and are able to, I guess, communicate what at least the companies I work for, more of the discovery response plan. So I'm curious, Dave and also Ed, what do you see as far as that role? Is it something that you're seeing that could be beneficial? Do you see companies going to that or not?
I do see companies going to it. In fact, I was recently assigned to help write a job description with qualifications for such an discovery response manager who would be in charge of record holds as well as discovery responses. Now, whether there's enough litigation at a particular company to justify that as a full-time position obviously depends on the company and the industry they're in and their litigation history. But to the extent that you can get this knowledge concentrated into one or a few people, it's a huge benefit in preparing for litigation.
By the way, I'd like to add, Dave Cohen asked earlier if there were any resumes for people like that. You should be sending those to special counsel or a staffing company. I'll give them to Dave, okay? Anyway, go on.
And this is Ed Wolf. In answer to that, Jim, the way I look at it, I think the jury's still out a little bit on exactly where we're going to end up. That being said, I'm certainly preparing people fulfill some portion of that role and have utilized people both from the IT side of the house and from the business unit side of the house who are knowledgeable about the data to assist the attorneys who can come in, not a pure discovery manager, but kind of a content knowledgeable and IT knowledgeable team.
Thanks.
Okay, I've got a question here. Let me see. Actually, this one came from another manufacturing company. how do you handle the e-discovery obligations for the smaller 250 or so EEOC complaints you might receive in a year, in contrast to the periodic large-scale SEC investigation, which have clear procedures in place already for gathering all types of information?
I think the process you have to have a scalable process, because you can experience, you know, an e-discovery onslaught in smaller investigations and smaller cases as well. So I think it's just a matter of making sure your process is scalable from all ends of the spectrum, because you are still dealing with the same data sets. So it's just a matter of being able to tackle them.
One interesting issue that comes up with EEOC types of complaints is, to what extent can you trust the holders of documents to produce relevant documents? Traditionally in discovery, back in the paper world, when we got a discovery request, we would contact the potential witnesses at a company and ask them to provide their documents and pretty much trust them to do so, you know, do some due diligence and interview them, but trust the employees. Well, these days, when you have certain kinds of claims, such as harassment claims, discrimination claims, sometimes the basis of those claims, as we saw in the Zublade case, there are going to be emails that are relevant to them, or even instant messages in today's world. And the question is, can you trust the accused to supply all of that information? It's an issue that hasn't been decided, but I think as a matter of common sense, there are certain situations where you would want your IT personnel to go and gather those records rather than trusting, you know, the accused to supply everything that's potentially relevant to those kinds of claims.
I think, putting aside the EEOC-type claim, I think regardless of any type of claim you have in any area, you have to have in place the ability to have your IT people capture mailboxes and the like, and then it's a judgment call as to in what situations you would use that that approach.
Okay. All right.
Carl, it's Jim. Is it okay if I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Okay. David Martin referred to something I think very, very critical early on in this discussion about structured and unstructured, and he saw that more of the emphasis and more of the challenge will be with the structured data.
David's going to have a heck of a reputation at the end of this.
That's right. So, David, I agree with that, but I want to see if you could elaborate a little bit why you see that being more of the future in terms of the challenges and where the emphasis is going to be.
With the reason I see that is the future is that so much of the litigation we're involved with, the people that bring that litigation, that sue us, you know, have kind of grown up and have read in the Wall Street Journal and what have you about emails, and so their focus is on emails. That's what they say is the voice of the company. So that's where they're looking for their, quote, smoking guns, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as we go into these Rule 26 conferences and we tell people what we have, every corporation tells people what their electronically stored information is. It's relevant, the sources of that. I think that your counsel that are suing your big corporations are going to become more sophisticated. And they're going to say, we need to take a look at what I call the structured data, which are databases and other routine things, so that they can take them and manipulate them, review them, manipulate them, look at them in a different fashion and in a different way. And so maybe I'm concerned about it that they're just simply getting into the corporation in a different way. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that they're going to be instantly raising the questions about wanting that in native format and wanting to take a look at a lot of highly confidential, highly proprietary, highly important information to the companies, and they're going to move into that area. Mm-hmm. And I just think that we haven't really dealt with any of the problems in collecting or finding that old data that's no longer being used, and how do we How do we disclose that? How do we provide databases? How do we provide that structured data and information? And there's significant cost to it, significant cost in trying to redact some information that's highly confidential, proprietary. I just think it's issues we haven't really faced with in production.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the next battleground.
Agreed.
And it's just, it's a few years out there, but that's where they're going, in my opinion.
Do we have other questions coming in from
the
switchboard?
Yes, we do. I'll take the next question from Atlanta, Georgia. Go ahead with your question, please, Atlanta, Georgia.
Hello, can the panel hear me?
Yep.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I've also found it very interesting, very helpful. One of the questions I had was whether the panel could recommend some sourcing for scenarios that we could put into place with our IT folks that would allow them to go through the process short of being in advance of litigation. If those exist somewhere by industry type, the panel knew that information.
Carl?
That sounds like a Jim Michaelowitz
question. Well, no, I just want to make sure. I didn't catch the first part. I thought you said sourcing. And would you mind just repeating the question one more time?
Sure. If there are some scenarios, I mean, oftentimes when you're talking to your IT people, they're asking the legal people, well, give us an example of something that could occur where we would have to, you know, retrieve this data. And, you know, apart from in the legal department at the desk thinking of all the ways that some clever attorneys may be able to sue the company or some regulator might request documents, whether that already exists for folks that are creating these programs to go ahead and run as sort of drills for IT folks or for anyone else in, that would be working on these kinds of projects.
Well, let me respond to that. This is David Martin. I don't know that there are any particular ones, but I think you'll learn a lot if you just ask them to retrieve some data.
Okay.
Frankly, if you test their systems, and a lot of them are concerned with backup or archiving or you know, the retention of certain documentation and everything, and they say, yeah, we've got all of this, ask them to retrieve it.
Okay.
Demonstrate it to you. And so you know the inside of your company, and you know some stuff, and you know what might be asked for, and ask them to do it, and I think you'll be surprised.
Okay.
I don't know if this...
And not pleasantly.
Right.
I don't know if this helps, and it's probably off point. This is Jim Michaelowitz. There are some documents that are available online, which is more to prepare the IT people, but it's more in the scenario of what kind of questions could be asked through interrogatories and also 30B6 questions, which kind of just says where is data located and what is the process that you do to retrieve data as well as preserve data. And what I had used in the past were a series of tests. And this goes back, you know, many, many, many years ago. And there used to be a plaintiff's attorney on the West Coast who I did seminars with. And I took basically his form of deposition questions and also interrogatories and said, let's apply it to ourselves internally and see, could we pass this test? And since that time, we developed different tests. So I called it the Zubelake test, again, to see how would we respond to the various type of questions and scenarios. And then there's another one which I use, which I called it the Milberg-Weiss test, which was noted plaintiff counsel is the type of questions we would get from them, a lot of times related to ESI and our ability, again, to retrieve, preserve, review, and produce, all those different steps like that. So some of those things are available. If you wanted to, after this call, even contact Carl, he could maybe put me in contact with you, and I could provide you with some of those tests.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Yeah, I'll throw in that, you know, there are sources. One way to find out the common kinds of requests is to go and look at some of the famous cases out there on eDiscovery, and there's a number of different websites where you can find them. We did that. Actually, we had a group of summer associates review eDiscovery cases and then use that as a basis to create a mock case, which we've used for instructional purposes. We filmed 8 videotaped vignettes, which we call scenes from an eDiscovery case, which sort of trace a lot of the issues that have come up across many of the published cases, and that includes everything from when the case first comes in, conversation between in-house and outside counsel, to the deposition of the e-discovery records managers of the two parties to actually a courtroom scene at the end. And where we got the ideas for that was simply by looking at the published e-discovery cases. So I'd recommend that that would be one place to look. But I think going through that brainstorming exercise is a very good exercise to be prepared for potential requests in the future.
Hey, I have a question here from Pittsburgh, and it was emailed to me, and sorry, if you have access and you know my email, that certainly is a good way to get a question in. A good friend of mine in Pittsburgh, one of the speakers commented that the pursuit of, quote, structured data would be the next big thing in e-discovery. Could he expand on this and include his definition of structured and unstructured data? What? Okay.
I think I already answered that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm just reading it. All right. Do we have another question out there? Yeah, my email is such a... I asked my company to let me use KAS, which is my old email, but it didn't fit with the technology parameters of our email box. So it's karl.schieneman@specialcounsel.com. We're at 4:30 right now. I don't know if we have one other question.
I have no further questions.
Late. Excuse me?
There is no further questions.
There are no further questions? Okay. Well, that's great. I want to thank everyone. If you do want to send me an email question, I'd be happy to distribute it to the panel. I want to thank them for doing a great job, and I promised them all an authentic autograph Laura Zubelik wine bottle for some e-discovery wine I have called the 4C. It ties into the Zubelik opinion. And I'd just like to add for the people in Pittsburgh, I'm going to hand out a couple of copies of this next door, right when we're done, if anyone's interested. So that's, I guess, about it. Thank you for tuning in, and I think it was a good panel. Thanks, everyone, for being involved.
Thank you, Carl.
Thanks, Carl.
Thank you.